This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, welcome, and thank you all for attending the National Museum's behind-the-scenes talk with our conservators. My name is Daniel Oakman. I'm one of the senior curators here at the museum. My job today is really just to provide a bit of background to the Landmarks Gallery and to introduce our conservators and the objects that they'll be talking about. But my first job is to kindly ask you to all turn off your mobile phones. As I'm sure most of you will know by now, that the Landmarks Gallery presents a very broad history of Australia since European colonisation, and it has really become the museum's signature statement about the history of Australia. And it addresses 10 themes, from colonial foundations of our capital cities to journeys of exploration, the discovery of gold, the quest for scientific understanding, the expansion of agriculture, mining and manufacturing, and the emergence of our highly urbanised cities. Now, in developing the gallery, we were concerned to move away from very abstract ideas of national history and any assertion that Australia is a single entity or that Australians are all the same. Instead of trying to tell this very broad and abstract story, we felt that we should focus on particular places and particular encounters, particular historical encounters in those places. So we've aimed to look at how Australians have lived in these particular places, engaged with their local landscapes and ecologies, the technologies that they have used to build their lives and societies. So Landmarks really explores the diversity of our lives across Australia, and while also drawing out the connections and similarities in the Australian experience. Now, it seems like an obvious thing to say that objects are central to the way Landmarks presents history, but in other ways, it isn't. For many years, I think Australian history, or at least the version that I had grown up with during the 1980s, and it didn't really look at objects, the material culture or the evidence of the past, didn't really feature. Rather, we learnt from books and printed material, and while the objects were there, they tended to serve as props, really as illustrations for the real history that appeared in history books. So when we looked at developing Landmarks, we really looked to move away from that method of history and that method of exhibition making. We wanted to embrace the museum's tradition of undertaking complex and detailed investigative work on objects and then bring that knowledge and that spirit of inquiry to bear in the gallery. Now, one way we did this was to work closely with conservators, both here and around the country, to really understand the objects that we're including in the gallery. And working with conservators, of course, meant that we were working with the people who spend a great deal of their time looking closely at these objects. Now, we wanted to know not just what materials these objects were made of or when they were made, rather we wanted to investigate and preserve the less tangible heritage that is contained in each of these objects, including the craft and skills that went into the object's construction. We're also interested in peeling back the layers to see how other people had treated the objects over the years. Now, the three conservators who will speak to us today have been a vital part of that process and that process of making the Landmarks Gallery, and I think we can all expect to hear some really intriguing and detailed stories about some of the work that they've undertaken. The first object that we'll hear about is, in fact, one of the largest that the museum's ever had to deal with, and that's the Simplex windmill. Now, one of the themes that we explore in Landmarks is the expansion of the pastoral frontier during the 19th century and the cultural and economic dynamics that powered that expansion. In the Grazing the Grasslands module, we look at some of the challenges and constraints that people faced in learning and adapting to Australian conditions, and perhaps the greatest of these has been the search for water. Now, the windmill that you see as you enter Landmarks, which has itself become something of a symbol of the gallery, of course, has a very particular story outside of its iconic status. And just to give you a brief background about the windmill, it has come from a region in central Queensland known as Bowen Downs. It was in the 1860s when the colonial government opened up this region for pastoral development. The explorers William Lansborough and Nat Buchan, they rode into central Queensland and discovered the undulating plains and rich pastures of Mitchell grass. The Nat Buchan became the first manager of the Bowen Downs area, and he quickly faced the challenges of raising cattle and sheep in this very remote region. The local Aboriginal people fought to retain access to their land and water. Dingoes attacked his flocks, waterways dried up, and stock had to be walked long distances to market. And after 5 years, Buchan and Lansborough both walked away, defeated by these challenges. In the late 1920s, Claude and Georgina Seacombe acquired a portion of the Kensington Downs station, which is just next door to Bowen Downs, which included the mill we now have in the gallery. They named it Kenya Station. This particular mill continued pumping water until 1988, when the family then sunk a deeper bore into the Great Artesian Basin, which actually sent water to the surface under pressure. So this, they were actually replacing sheep with cattle, which actually required more water than the windmill we now have could actually draw. John Seacombe, who is a great-nephew of Claude, and his wife Pamela kindly donated the mill to the museum in 2008. Now, to tell us more about the treatment and reconstruction of the mill, I'd like to introduce the museum's conservator, Ainsley Greiner. Thanks, Ainsley.
Take a moment. Okay, I'm going to give a bit of an overview of some of the processes that we went through with the Simplex windmill. I'm going to show you some slides of it actually being pulled down and then look at some of the treatment aspects and then some of the innovations that we made to actually set it back up in the landmarks. Gallery. As Daniel has said, it was from the Kenya station up near Murrumburra. Well, in Murrumburra, up near Longreach, and this is it standing on the property. As it was. The disassembly of it occurred in 2008 in July, so it's in the middle of winter when it was actually happening. So it's a bit surreal, actually, sort of, you know, being in Canberra, thinking about this and the heat and, you know, what it's like up in central Queensland, you know, whilst this was being done. But these sort of images give you an idea of the scale of it. You know, it really is an imposing thing. In sort of old imperial measurements, it's about 40 foot high, and it has a sail, like a fan, of about 20 feet. And from the front of the fan to the tip of the tail is about 10 feet. Okay. And according to the catalogue of the time in the 1920s, it sort of boasted a few things about, you know, the merits of this particular mill. The company sort of stated that, you know, all IBC Simplex towers have four legs, which, you know, are the strongest form that can be built. The legs are made of angled steel, and they butt one on the other and are secured with heavy angle steel spliced pieces that were strongly bolted together, and they had girts of angled steel and braces of flat steel, and they also boasted that their bolt holes were industrially punched, you know, with heavy machinery. What you don't see is what's happening under the ground, and the legs extend into the ground a distance depending on the size of the mill and the height of the tower. So it would be considerable. It would be several feet, I would imagine. And these feet had anchor plates and angled steel pieces that sort of braced the or kept it firmly planted in the ground. And you can see that there's some concrete sort of reinforcing around the base of the feet just above the ground there as well. They also boasted that the platform was extra large, and it was made of really first quality top grade hardwood, which was supported by a steel sort of subframe. Okay, so it is missing. Yeah, that's right. It's gone through a fair bit of wear and tear over the 80 odd years, I would imagine. You'll notice that the sail, the fan, has also been chained to the tower, and from the story goes that one young jackaroo was getting a little bit tired of hearing this fan sort of tick over at night. You know, it sort of rattled and it squeaked and it squealed and made a lot of noise, and it sort of made a lot of banging. So basically he chained it to the tower and promptly forgot about it. And sure enough, a windy day, it sort of, the fan wanted to spin round with the wind and it couldn't, and so it sort of rotated and spun around the tower and sort of caused all sorts of damage. So you can see that there's a bit of damage to the sails and to some, the outer ring and one or two of the arms of the fan. This sort of gives you, I can't believe, facing this and even, wanting to climb this, it's incredible. I can't imagine, getting up there and servicing this thing and making sure that all the various parts are greased and oiled. But these guys are well versed in this sort of work, and it's a team of brothers from the local district, the Rose brothers. I think they're the third generation of windmill mechanics in the area, and this is what they do. They climb these things and they put them up and they pull them down. It's really quite incredible. You can see them now sort of taking some of the sails off, and it's interesting, the process and the way they do it. You'll notice in the bottom right corner there that they actually take them off at opposing angles to each other. That's because the fan needs to be balanced. If you take too many off on one side, it just rotates, it spins, and it really is dangerous. It just takes off on you, and that's something that we found, or we... They, once the sails are off, they load them down with a pulley and a rope and load them down to the ground. Started taking the outer rings off once all the sails were off. And you're left with the arms. And you can see one in particular is, really, really quite bent. So what do you do with all the heavy gear that's underneath it? Bring in a really big crane and you start slinging things and pulling them off and lowering them to the ground, and notice how this guy, he's standing right on top of the turntable. It's absolutely mind-boggling. It's fantastic. In this shot here, on the bottom left here, you've actually got the two brothers and their father actually working together to uncouple the pin that's holding the tail to the turntable. They're not wearing any safety gear at all. Okay. They've got elastic sided boots on with heels and and hats to keep the sun off. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Too far away from occupational health and safety.
But I suspect that these guys have been doing it since, you know, day dot. You know, they're probably climbing it like monkeys when they were kids. You know, it's I think it's obviously part of their life, and, you know, they've been doing it for years. So basically we're getting to the bottom part of the tower, and you'll notice that they cut the tower from the base. So all the sub feet and what have you, we didn't get that. You know, it's all still in the ground. And basically they flat packed it like an IKEA, you know, cupboard set of shelves, and loaded it onto some trucks, you know, and brought it down to us. So what we were faced with in the lab when it first arrived was this, you know. It's a giant Meccano set. You know, hundreds of bolts, nuts and bolts, in really poor condition, which we basically re-threaded and treated. We tried to do that with as many of the original bolts that we possibly could. We also were faced with, surfaces like this, you know, that are heavily ingrained with rust and dirt concretions and oil and grease, you know, heavily caked on, which sort of shows the history, the working history of the object, you know, over 80-odd years. And we were asked to retain as much of this as possible, like, you know, which is interesting, you know. I think it's terrific, you know, it's a really nice way of approaching things. But what we did do was we had to look at all the internal working surfaces of the moving parts. And this here is the main big end bearing. And you can see that it's uneven. It obviously has had a really hard life. It's had a real flogging. And we were faced with, you know, how we were going to approach assembly with these problems. These are the slipper bearings that are found inside, or that wrap around the crank at that journal. You can see this is the lower one, the bottom one. So as the crank went over each time, it sort of came down with a thud, and it's basically worn away that bearing there. Which was, you know, a soft metal. It was a white metal. And these are the sort of main bearings, main journals at either side, which sort of hold the crank in place. And you can see that, you know, servicing was probably a bit irregular and a bit haphazard. Although it was done, it was sort of, you can see by the wear on some of these surfaces and some of the build-up of dirt and concretions that, you know, obviously it's been working. So, well, yeah, I've said it. Servicing's been irregular. And what's happened on the inside of these journals is that you had a lot of scoring and wear from the grit from the dirt. So rather than... We had two options. We could approach the crank with the option of regrinding it, or of grinding it, and making new bearings to suit. But we knew that because it was going to be inside, that it wasn't going to be exposed to wind. And, you know, we knew that it was going to rotate very, very slowly, the fan. So we were fortunate enough to have the skills of a couple of very competent elder statesmen in engineering who are able to make things, you know, with machines. And they both Cole and Ian have made two slipper bearings there to the dimensions of that worn crank bearing, which is a good thing because it's a soft metal and it's not going to actually cause any more damage or any more harm to that worn journal, to that worn one bearing. This is it fitted in place, and you'll notice that in the top left there, what we do with replacement components is that we date them, we sign them, and we autograph them to state that it's not an original part, that the museum made it, and that it's a sacrificial part. The bearings that have come off it, we've archived, and now they're part of the collection. Some other issues that we were facing is that this is the top of the turntable. We had, you know, two sort of carriages of these roller bearings. You can see that on the inside of one of the rings there, there's a big build-up of grease and congealed dry sort of grease. Again, we retained that. We cleaned all the working surfaces where the bearings were rolling or are to roll, and we re-greased them with inhibited grease. This is the tailpin, and you can see that it's had a hard life as well. We found it very difficult to try to pull this out of the tail. It really was very, very difficult to remove due to wear. So once we got it out, we made a new one because we knew that we were going to have to fit the tail to the tower inside the gallery, and we just didn't want it to be hard. So we made one to suit the, you know, the worn sort of journals for the pin. This is the universal joint of the centre shaft that pumps up and down. Again, we found excessive wear in it, and it just wobbles. So, you know, we actually trialled it whilst we had it set up, and we realised that it was just wobbling all over the place. So the guys made an insert out of some Teflon, a nylon on the lathe, which sort of minimised that play. And they also made some bronze bushes for some of the other moving components on that universal joint. These are some of the arms. Again, you know, they're bent due to damage. We approached it. We decided to straighten them, and we applied heat and used some innovative techniques to straighten them to get them into shape. We also gave the tower and components that didn't have any moving parts a really nice sort of light clean with a mild detergent, you know, just to remove the dust and some of the dirt. But all the heavier concretions and the bird poo and that sort of stuff that stayed, you know, we left it there. We didn't use any great force to try and get it off. What we also found was that we knew nothing about windmills and setting them up, and we basically had to work out a technique of actually assembling it. And what you see here is the lower section of the windmill as you see it in the gallery. And it was designed and engineered by a local engineering company. And as you can see from the shot on the right, it really is a very close resemblance to the original material. So although it looks new, it's totally appropriate for the overall aesthetic of the object. So this is us working out various ways of getting this thing together, and you know, you'll notice that we're using platforms and personnel cages and forklifts, and rather than lifting things with cranes, we had to sort of lift, you know, the arms and what have you, you know, by hand, by in person. So the other thing that we were faced with was that we wanted to see, well, it was desirable for the thing to be operational, or at least looking as though it was actually rotating and turning. So we got our heads together, and we fitted an electric 240 volt motor to it. You know, it's coupled to a very low geared gearbox, and I believe it spins about 1.6 rotations in per minute. The guys also engineered a bracket, an adjustable bracket for it, which allowed us to sort of put tension on the chain, the driving chain. You can see in the bottom right-hand corner, the guys also engineered or altered or modified a sprocket, which you can see coupled at the centre in the crankshaft there, and the chain going down to the motor. And that wasn't an easy task. It took a lot of effort to actually get that exactly right and the alignment of those two sprockets correct, you know, so that the chain would spin round properly. The other thing is that we were faced with lifting the tail into position, and again, without a crane, we can't really lift it up with any great ease, so we developed a jig for it, and it has an adjustable column on it, which enabled us to adjust, do fine adjustments on the coupling, the pin coupling, so that we could actually align that into exact position so that we could just slot the pin through without any great difficulty. And this is us sort of trialling it for the first time in the workshop. We're on site. We were the first. This was the first object to go in, and basically the work site was completely cleared for us, and we were left for 3 days, 4 days to set it up, which was great. It was nice not to have a crowd or any spectators. I mean, these sort of tasks are really stressful. Like, you know, it takes a lot of patience, and you've really got to take your time with these things. But as you can see, we didn't have much room to work with. You know, we got there. It's an interesting process. Setting up the arms and the sails. Again, as it was pulled down, we sort of opposed them as we put them on, and we also developed a new hardwood deck for it, and we sourced that from a local timber yard in Queanbeyan. And apparently the wood that we used had been sitting on site for almost 40 years, but some of the cut edges were actually clean and not weathered. So if you want to artificially age some timber, just get some steel wool and put it in a jar of white vinegar and leave it overnight, and then actually paint it on, and you'll find that within a day it ages the wood really, really well. And that's us putting the deck together. And there it is, in the gallery. So, any questions?
Did you find out how they got it up in the first place, given the amount of struggle you had to get it up?
I don't know. It would be a fascinating process. It would have been lovely to see it being pulled down, but again, it's mind-boggling. We had nothing to work with, you know.
You were talking earlier about the... I think, of course, it's... You're talking about getting the whole history of these particular objects and
yep.
the people involved, and it'd be really nice to know how...
Oh, absolutely,
they,
I agree.
They, you know, how they got it up, because watching them...
Absolutely.
Just pull it down, it was torturous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And to get it up there... And how do they service it, for goodness sake?
I imagine they climb up and they climb it, scramble over it.
They climb up, but
yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. It really is amazing. I mean, I was scared at like two metres off the ground, you know. I you know, a small platform and you're holding things and putting them into place. I just didn't want to look at the ground.
I struggle with the little step ladder.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
It's all right.
A lot of the sails were damaged when it was hooked up So did you have to make replacement sales, or were you able to use the sales that were originally there? But
We did straighten some of them, but we were also fortunate that we had surplus. There were sort of five or six extras that weren't as damaged that we could actually work with. So rather than, you know, try to straighten one completely, a really damaged one, we actually worked with the less so.
I noticed on your sales down here you've left the rust shown there. That been stabilised? I mean, all those holes there are all rusty.
The original bolts and screws and what have you, yes, we did stabilise them, but the original sort of rust surfaces on the sails we didn't stabilise. We knew that it was going to be in a relatively stable environment, and it wasn't going to be exposed to huge fluctuations in, you know, temperature or relative humidity. So we knew that they were going to be, you know, quite safe, and there was no indication of any new active corrosion. So, you know, we believe that they're actually going to be okay. And part of the original intent for the overall look of it was to keep as much of the original appearance as possible. So, yeah, we let that go.
How long's the whole project taken?
It took us about 18 months from go to woe, and the assembly took 3 days. Yeah, but actually developing that technique took us a few weeks. You know, it was slowly, you know, and each step, you know, we sort of worked out the best way that we could do it and wrote up a process and wrote up a safe work method statement and wrote a risk assessment, and we sort of went through working at heights training, and, you know, it was a very sort of systematic approach. Yeah, it took a lot of time and effort and consideration.
How did you get onto it in the first place? Did the owners contact you?
The owners actually, I believe, this may be wrong, but they contacted one of our conservators who have a small property in a house in Muttaburra. And she was, you know, friends with this particular family. So they sort of got talking, and I think that's how that started that, yeah.
Just being a bit aware of the time, I think we might move on. But thanks again to Ainsley. And if I could just ask people, when it comes to question time, if they could wait for Luke to bring up the microphone, because we're actually recording this, which I believe might be available online afterwards. All right, moving on. The next person we'll be hearing from is Carmela, one of our conservators, and she'll be talking about the particular dress from the Springfield collection. And one of the other themes that the Landmarks Gallery considers is the social life in these often very remote places. And one of those places that's in the gallery is Springfield, which is just this side of Goulburn. And just very, very briefly, to paint you a bit of a picture of the history there, in 1829, it was a 21-year-old man called William Pitt Faithful who left Sydney to take up 1,200 acres of land on the Gundary Plain. And here he established Springfield, which was a merino stud with rams and ewes from the best Australian flocks. And through a careful breeding program, he developed sheep renowned for their large size, hardiness, and heavy, high-quality fleeces. Now, by the turn of the century, Springfield had grown into a prosperous station with a grand homestead surrounded by a very formal English garden. Now, in 2008, descendants of the Faithful family actually sold part of their land holdings, including the homestead, but they themselves continued to live on the station. But these descendants, Jim and Pamela Maple Brown, also donated a major collection of material from the homestead, and it forms one of the largest and richest collections in the museum's holdings. Now, Carmela is going to talk to us about a particular dress that was worn by one of the Faithful family's three daughters. We think it was made in around about 1905 and probably worn to important social events in the district, particularly the Tirana picnic races. This was a very exclusive horse race meeting held at Tirana, which is just near Springfield, and was attended by the mostly by the wealthy pastoral families in that that region. So please welcome Camilla.
Different to the windmill. Not quite as large, not quite as rusty, but certainly had a bit of damage on it as well. So Daniel mentioned where the collection came from. That's when I went out to have a look at it. That's what I was looking at, a wardrobe with these lovely costumes in it. And if you look closely, you can actually see the dress that you saw in the previous image, just hanging, just the bottom part of... I haven't got a pointer, but hopefully you can see it there. So once it arrived to us, of course, we made up a lovely customised box for it and padded it all out, and that's how it sits in our storage areas. And then in 2010, I think it was, George Main, who's a curator, who was working on the module, mentioned that he would like me to have a look at this dress and see if we could possibly put it on display. So I went and had a look at it, and that's where it all started. So what I'll do today is just briefly go through the documentation, treatment and display preparation for the dress. Try and go through as quickly as I can. Documentation's one of our, as conservators, one of our main areas that we do spend a lot of time on, because that's where we become close to the object. We work out the condition of it. We take measurements for further display preparation. We measurements that help into the actual development of the display cases, etc. So there's a lot of time spent just sitting there and looking at the object in detail. At this time, there's lots of photos taken, analysis, fibre ID. So I went through and identified the fibres on this garment. So I discovered that there's, you know, it's cotton and silk. So it's, you know, an interesting combination. And when I first looked at the garment from the outside, it's, you know, great. It doesn't look like it needs much doing to it until I actually opened it up and had a look inside. So, like I said, in the documentation side of it, we look at the construction. It was a two-piece garments, so we had a lovely skirt and a bodice, and quite for that the Edwardian period, it fitted quite nicely in there. The high collar, the loose skirts, as opposed to previous to that, we were wearing dresses with huge bustles and a lot of weight, and being a very light gauze fabric with a black background and a white printed dot on it. It's sort of, I suppose, starting to fit into the Australian climate because it's quite warm and warm here. We also find out that the dress was made in London, so we've already got two different, quite different environments. When we look at it on the inside, you can see the maker's tag. The number of seams and boning in there, that's also gives us an indication of the period later in the period of dress history. Construction was becoming more involved, so they were understanding how to make these beautiful garments. So you see a lot of detailed work there. And like I said earlier, when I opened it up, that's where all the damage was. Obviously, being worn in probably at the races in the hot weather here in Australia, being silk, perspiration, body oils over time has caused the fabric to shatter and disintegrate. And I'll have further photos further on. The skirt, again, it was lovely, light, opening at the back with hooks and eyes. Beautiful frill on the end of the hem, and that was quite common in a lot of these garments, just to keep them clean, and it was also an area that could be removed and cleaned without having to clean the whole garment, because you can imagine having to, I mean, they didn't have washing machines like we do today, and garments are a lot more detailed than what we're wearing these days, so the cleaning process wasn't a regular, you know, wash once, wear once, throw in the wash sort of thing, so you're wearing them quite often. So they constructed the garment with frills to capture all the dirt and dust, and that could be removed and cleaned. And further sort of investigation on the hem, noticed that there were burrs just scattered throughout the hem, which sort of picks up, okay, well, it was worn on the farm or at the races, so there's a bit of a connection there, which is really lovely to find. So it's just a bit more detail on the damage in the inside of the garment. Perspiration, a lot of staining on the lace as well. So you could say, well, it's all on the inside. We can't, you know, the visitor can't see the damage, so why do we have to go through the process of doing anything with it? Well, it did have to go on a mannequin for display, so and any handling would cause further damage to it. So that's the process we sort of think about when we undertake our the treatment. So you can see there's quite a lot of perspiration around the lace neck. You can see my fingers just holding the silk. It was a facing that sort of went around the neckline, and some was more shattered than others. So further on, the skirt, the same. All the silk lining near the opening was literally in a bundle of fibres. And there was a previous repair on it. And I suppose another thing, we'd look at previous repairs and do they tell us a story? Do we remove them? Are they causing any further damage to the item? So we go through all that thought process before we actually sit down and undertake the treatment. So these are the sort of things that I was thinking about when thinking, trying to determine the proposal. How much would the treatment would the dress require to be safely displayed without further damage occurring? Do I unstitch the bodice lining to stabilise it? Do I unstitch all bodice facings and undertake adhesive repairs and restitch them? Do I wash the garment or just spot treat the stains? Do I remove the burrs found on the hem or not? So all these things I'm thinking. But one of the, I suppose, a treatment that we do, whether it's a garment or a large banner, is undertake a vacuuming process. And that just releases all the loose particles in the fibres. And sometimes we find that's all an item needs. It doesn't need to go any further than that. So that's just a couple of shots of me doing that. And we use a fine on the top corner there. Fly screen wire, not the wire metal one, but the softer one, and we place that over the garment and vacuum through that, so that we're not sucking up anything that we don't want to remove. There we've got the skirt hem with the burrs. When I found them, I contacted George, the curator, and had a chat to him and said, "Well, are you interested in keeping them in the garment or removing them?" And we having them there and in the environment they're in, they're not going to cause any further damage to the garment, but they do tell us a little bit of insight information about the garment, so we've decided to leave them there. So even through the vacuuming, they were not removed. There's quite a number of stains throughout the dress, especially on the skirt, and I did a number of tests to see, well, can I wash it, the entire thing, or not? And I thought, well, I don't know how many tests I did, and they're all positive. Yes, it's getting close to me being able to do a bit of overall cleaning. But the lace on the skirt was not stable. It didn't matter what I tried, it was not going to not run. So, which meant that I had to go to the other option and just spot treat all the stains on the skirt, which obviously took a bit longer than having to immerse the whole thing and in a solution. Then cleaning again, I couldn't clean the whole bodice, so cleaning all the perspiration staining off the collar. Now, perspiration is the process that I'm doing here is really removing all the oils that are left in the garment and has caused a lot of that damage in the silk. It doesn't necessarily remove the staining because that's, quite difficult to remove and we can't do that, but all the oils and all the impurities are removed at that point in time. So that was done for the collar and also this lace cuffs on the bodice. Just the silk facings that were in, again, this discussion with other colleagues and curators as well. How far do we take this treatment? And it's similar to what Ainsley was saying with the windmill and the bearings and things like that. So do I remove it and replace it with new lining? Do I leave it and try and stabilise it in the way it is now? Do I unstitch it, flatten, stabilise, and then replace it? So you'll see as I go further, I've used a combination of these techniques for depending on what it was. And on the skirt, it was literally in a bundle of fibres that there was nothing much more I could do. Couldn't do much with it unless I did remove it. So you can see me unstitching there. We keep all the original threads and reuse them wherever possible. The original holes where the threads have gone into, we mark those and we then restitch back into those holes. It was taken off, relaxed, flattened, and then we did an adhesive repair. So you can see me in this bottom corner, it's already been flattened. I'm now doing an adhesive repair. That's a fine little iron that low heat. So attaching the two, so then when I come to restitch it, I can actually handle the item and it's intact, as opposed to the top corner where it's in a big bundle of silk. It's just another image of it. You can see me stitching. So it's a lot. And we use what we call a silk crepeline, which is a very fine fabric, and silk was used because the lining was silk, and we try and keep the same materials in our repairs wherever possible. So the silk was used there. Then there were other areas where, the other thing I'm sort of faced against is time to get this work completed for the exhibition opening. So if I had removed that silk where the hooks and eyes, this is the bodice opening front. I would have to undo all the hooks just in the construction of it. The hooks would need to be removed, unstitched. So there was quite a lot of deconstructing of that garment to do some of the work. And I suppose a conversation that we do have is, okay, we do want to keep the original, as much of the original construction work of any item, whether it's a windmill or a garment. So then we look at, okay, well, we don't want to remove it. How else can we stabilise this the best way we can? And the other option was to actually use that silk crepeline without adhesive and laying it over the top in various areas and stitching that to the garment through its original sort of stitching holes that are there. And that will hold the fabric in place. I used it here as opposed to previously on the skirt because it was just a bundle of fibres and I didn't even know where they belonged really. And the hooks and eyes were all loose as well, so there was less unstitching that had to be done there than in these areas. Then the other discussion, sorry about those photos. The other discussion was the actual, I think you noticed the damage that was on the sleeve in previous photos and the bodice itself. There was a discussion, do we deconstruct this whole garment and reproduce a whole new lining for it and replace it? Or, again, what's our other option? And the other option here was to use the silk crepeline again and combine both the adhesive technique, and you can see in the bottom part of the sleeve where I have used the silk crepeline to place behind and hold everything intact because it was sort of this area around the sleeve and it was just, you know, if I'd put a mannequin arm through there or any form of handling of that area, I would just pull it apart and as gentle as I could be with it. So we've used the crepeline for that and then made, obviously my pattern making skills had to come in place here and reconstructed a sleeve using silk hepatae, a loose one that encased the whole sleeve, but you can still get to the original if need be, but it provided a support for display. And you can see that the stitching in this top part of the sleeve here and the full sleeve at the other side. And then there was another little thing that was a bit odd, and this beautiful garment and this velvet rosette, well, what should have, you know, was supposed to be a little rosette, didn't look like one. It was held together with pins and wire and everything, and it just didn't quite fit the full look of this garment. So, again, ring up curator George and said, come out and have a look at this, and had a look at some historical photos as best as I could find to see, well, yes, that's how it probably would have looked. So we've decided that we would undo a bit of stitching because it seemed like it was just put a few stitches there just to hold it. It wasn't what it was like originally. So finally at the top corner, that rosette has been formed to sit nicely at the centre of that garment. Then, okay, I've done all the conservation work, now I'm ready for displaying, and so a lot of research even goes into that process on getting it out on display. So we sort of look at the look, how is it to look, how did they, when someone was wearing it, what did it look like? So just searching through images. Also looking at undergarments, it's a main component of our display process of costume is getting the right undergarments for it. And obviously this costume did not come with its underpinnings or anything. So then we need to create them ourselves to get the right look. Just flick over to... We use two types of mannequins here at the museum for our period costumes. One is what we call an ether-foam mannequin, and we actually carve that. That's a stable plastic that's easily carved in with a carving knife, and shape it to the right size. And you can see where I'm here on this particular garment, which is also a Springfield garment displayed in Australian Journeys, and it's got a bustled effect. So I'm creating that bustle in the mannequin and then adding additional padding to create the final look. So that's one form, but then we were lucky enough to purchase some lovely Kyoto Japanese period mannequins, and they come already styled in that particular style. So we've got 18th century, 19th century mannequins that we then... They're quite flexible. As you can see, they've got a central bit there to accommodate the very small waists that a lot of these garments have. And we... For this particular garment, that's what we ended up using. We still need to put a layer of padding just to protect and soften the mannequin. So there's quite a bit of time involved in that. Then drafting a petticoat or undergarments for the costume. And again, a lot of these are... look at period patterns that you can source. If I had an original petticoat in the collection and it was in a condition that I could draft a pattern from, then I would consider that. So this is just the process of getting that petticoat done. And sometimes it takes longer than actual the treatment of the object. And just some there. So now we've covered our mannequin, made our petticoat, and we're pretty much now ready to dress it. So we go through the process. And this garment here had two petticoats. You can see a shorter one on that top one and then a longer one over the top to create the look that we needed. Sometimes you're creating like three petticoats for the one garment. If it was a bustled one, then you'd create a bit of a bustle on it as well. So we're starting to dress. We've got the skirt and everything on. The tape that was around the waist that had the manufacturer's label on it, that's needs to be pinned first. So another thing that we, you know, when we're dressing, we look at, okay, well, what's the sequence? How do we need to dress this to get it right? Obviously, you know, you dressing yourself is quite different to dressing a mannequin. They don't actually move the way you want them to, and so it makes it a lot harder to get garments on there. But that's another challenge, and sometimes it'll take up to an hour just to dress a mannequin. So this had lots of hooks and eyes in the front opening and around the neck, and you had to make sure that you matched up everyone correctly, otherwise you got to the end and, and you miss one out. And that's it. That's looking pretty good. So when you look at it, it doesn't look like much has been done to it, but... behind the scenes on the inside of the garment. There was quite a bit of work done on it. Thank you.
We've got time for just a couple of questions. You just wait for the microphone, thanks. Just up the back there, Luke.
Thanks. How long will that stay on display for?
It's definitely up for the next 2 years.
Yeah. Okay. And also, it's a little bit off the conservation track, but are you planning on, do you know if there's any plans to put any of your garments on the Australian Dress Register?
I think we do have three on there at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks again, Camilla. Just in the interest of keeping to time, I'll introduce Phyllab's Hut very briefly because I think it's probably an object that needs the least introduction. It's only to say that it's in the Flemington exhibit, which is in the Connecting the Nation module. So if you just head downstairs, you'll see it's got its own little display case. It's probably our most requested object, really, just narrowly ahead of the Holden prototype. But here to tell us more is the Deputy Manager of Conservation, Nikki Smith.
Good afternoon, everyone. Phyllab's Hut here at the National Museum is part of the larger wet specimen collection that came to us from the Institute of Anatomy. It's an example of growing awareness of Australian environment, and it contains endangered species such as, or other rare endangered or extinct species such as the thylacine, and it also contains some human remains. So Phyllab was a champion thoroughbred racehorse, as most of you will be aware. He was a particularly ugly or ungainly yearling who most considered had no chance of winning. And so he was seen, when he did win, he was seen as an Aussie battler, winning against the odds. And so at the time of the Depression, the difficult years of the Depression, this connected to the hopes and the dreams of the ordinary Australian. He was foaled in New Zealand, but he dominated Australian racing during the early 1930s, winning the 1930 Melbourne Cup, a couple of Cox Plates and many other weight for age races. He then won the richest race in North America, the Agua Caliente Handicap, in 1932. But then a fortnight later, he was dead of a mysterious illness. There was concern at the time that he was poisoned. And recent analysis conducted from some hair samples taken from his mane points to arsenic poisoning. Phyllab's Hut was remarkable for its size, weighing 6.2 kilograms, or that's 13.6 pounds, and this is compared with a normal horse's heart at 3.2 kilograms. This coined the phrase, as hard as big as Phyllab's, and Phyllab continues to be one of the most popular exhibits here at the museum, as Daniel has just mentioned. So after Phyllab's death, the heart was sent to the University of Sydney for examination and autopsy by a pathologist and a thoroughbred specialist. During this examination, part of the wall of the left ventricle was removed to show how thick the walls of the heart were. At that time, it was suggested to Harry Telford, Phyllab's part owner and trainer, that the heart be donated to the Australian Institute of Anatomy. And when this closed in 1984, it came here to the National Museum. So a common method of preparing museum specimens at that time was to fix the tissue in 40% formaldehyde for about 3 months. They were then sewn onto a backing or a mounting plate, placed into a preserving solution and then sealed in a jar. The preserving solution helps to support the specimen. It limits bacterial and fungal growth. It can limit colour change and shrinkage. But the preserving fluid also acts as a solvent, and some of the components of the specimen can extract out into the solution, such as lipids and proteins, and this can discolour the solution over time. Now, this does slow down over time, reaching an equilibrium, so our current approach is to try and limit changing the solution as far as possible. In Phyllab's case, the preserving solution is a modified Wentworth solution. This means it's about 20% glycerin, 75% water, 0.8% formalin, which acts as a germicide, and it has minor amounts of buffers in it to stabilise the pH. This is in contrast to many contemporary collections which hold their wet specimens in ethanol. Over the years, Farlap's heart has had a number of treatments. Cuts extend from the surrounding tissue, from where the section was removed, out into its surface, and the surface has been flaking over the past years. In 1985 and 86, it had several months of treatment at the Australian Museum and Department of Veterinary Science at the University of Sydney. It had connective tissue removed, so it was actually easier to see the heart. Mylar tubes were placed down into the large blood vessels. Sorry, I don't have a pointer, but I'll try and... So can you, hopefully you can see the mylar tube down in here in the large blood vessel. Smaller blood vessels were filled with gelatin. It was remounted onto a Perspex mount, and hopefully you can see up here the Perspex mount fitted around the outside of the heart. It was stitched onto this using nylon sutures. You can see down here holes with the nylon sutures down, holding it onto the Perspex mount. And there's some Perspex buttons here so that it doesn't pull through, or hopefully it doesn't pull through the heart. Cuts in the heart wall. Large cuts in the heart wall, such as here, were repaired with a cyanoacrylate, which is commonly known as a superglue, and the fatty areas were sealed with betacryl, which is a polyester a glue. And again, you can... Again, you can see... Maybe you can see some kind of... we call it goop, kind of build up here from the adhesive that has been placed over it in the past trying to seal it. And again, this large tear here up into the auricle had a band-aid of stable tex and glue across here trying to hold it together. It was also moved into a new container and had new fluid. The specialists working on it at the time noted that it was in relatively poor condition, being quite soft and spongy. So during the 1990s, the heart also had a number of solution changes because it was excessively cloudy and sediment was beginning to build up in the bottom of the container. And it's interesting, looking back at files from conservators, that's when vibration started to be noted as a concern for the stability of Farlap's heart. So then in 2005, 2006, in preparation for the new display case in the museum's Nation Gallery and a potential loan to New Zealand, for the first time in 20 years, Farlap's heart was removed from its container. And moving the heart out of the solution meant the numerous cuts, cracks, and so the large cuts and cracks and the numerous small cuts became obvious, as you saw in the previous slide. We approached a number of national and international experts regarding transport of the heart. These included Acoustics and Vibration Unit of University of New South Wales, vibration specialists at ADFA, and the Royal College of Surgeons in the United Kingdom. The general kind of conclusion for transport was that to minimise transfer of vibration, the heart should be removed from its solution and removed from its mount, but... For Farlap's heart, the solution, the fluid, actually supports the heart, and we didn't want to remove it from its Perspex mount because actually reattaching it to a mount would have required further stitching, which we didn't want to introduce more holes into the heart. Without extensive testing on the mechanical properties of Farlap's heart, a vibration specialist could not guarantee significant damage would not occur with travelling of the heart. So considering we only have one Farlap's heart and retaining its size was critical to its significance, our recommendation was the heart did not travel on loan. Some of you may remember media over the years requests to New Zealand and more recently a request to Victoria for Farlap's heart. So instead, the heart was transferred to its new container, and again, we tried to repair and stabilise some of the large tears using superglue, as had been used in the past, And again, we did a Band-Aid stable text repair using gelatin adhesive over some of the weaker areas with extensive cracking. So here you can see the hands of two of our conservators, Patria Kay and Tessa Iverson, working on Farlap's heart. Here it's undergoing adhesion down these very large cracks. Here we're trying to prop it up in solution and by keeping the heart wet while the adhesive dries. And after the large cracks were adhered, the two photos down below show the StableTex Band-Aid being adhered over these areas of weakness. So putting Farlap's heart on display in the Landmarks Gallery, the main risks were considered to be vibration and shock. Therefore, it's on display in the ground floor of our museum, which has the most stable concrete slab to limit vibration. It's in a showcase specifically designed so that the plates of the showcase are drilled directly into the concrete slab, and the surrounding vitrine around the outside of the heart is actually separate from the interior of the case, so that if people accidentally bump the outside of the case or if vibration from the floor doesn't transfer across into the heart. So movement of Farlap was done with a pneumatic lift trolley and using soft air-filled tyres. We surrounded the heart with soft absorbent foam, and any lift was done with two people. Here you can see Peter Buckey from our conservation section and Paul Paisley from registration, slowly and carefully moving the heart. It's actually easier and more safe that when there's any bumps or joints in the floor to actually lift the heart rather than moving it on a trolley over bumps. So, yes, we safely got it into the new showcase, and you're all welcome to go downstairs and have a look at it. So just in conclusion, I'd like to acknowledge Patria Kay on your right, who's the conservator that's done most of the work on our wet specimen collection and in particular Farlap over the last 10 years. Here she is trying to explain to a reporter why we weren't recommending the heart go on loan. Travel on loan. And here on your left is Tessa Iverson, again, kind of querying what the hell we were going to do with Farlap's heart and how we were going to hold them together. So thank you.
Any questions for Nikki?
Has any research been done into Farlap's progeny and the size of their hearts?
Not necessarily. He's a gelding. So, yes, his tree and his line of descent is very well known. But, yes, other famous and successful racehorses, some of them also have very large hearts. And there was some investigation into, yes, particular DNA that led to a large heart. But I'm not sure that any related directly to Farlap have been investigated. But yes, certainly other horses around the world have been found to have large hearts.
Hello, I was just wondering, can you estimate how long Farlap's heart will exist before it really just turns to mush?
That depends on how we treat it. And that's why one of our main recommendations is that it doesn't travel. It might have survived the travel process, but equally a large chunk of that top aureole section might have fallen off. And any vibration will just slowly shake it. So I think we're confident if we look after it well and maintain the solution well at a correct pH and keep the density of the solution so that it's actually floating rather than being pulled on those stitches, you know, we have hopes that he'll be around for quite a bit longer.
You mentioned that you've got quite an extensive collection of wet specimens. Do they all require regular monitoring of the solutions and change of the solutions, and how do you manage that?
Yes, that's a great question. Tessa, who we showed at the end, we actually came on board for a particular wet specimen project that we had going in 2005, 2006. And we were looking at some of those questions, what did need to be done to our entire wet specimen collection. Part of that process was to bring in a, or to have a significance assessment done on the collection to identify what was particularly significant about this collection and therefore what did we want to preserve from the collection. So in that, identified that the Australian specimens were particularly significant. Those that were rare and extinct were obviously highly significant. The way the collection was presented, the majority of the collection had been put together during the 1910s to about the 1930s by a Sir Colin McKenzie, who's quite a well-known Australian anatomist, and so it reflected construction and the way specimens were collected at that time. So it included beautiful glass jars, particular black sealant around the top, beautiful paper labels. So the significance assessment identified all of that as being of high importance to the National Museum. So that's all part of our treatment approach. It also, and then as from a conservation perspective, we looked at solution levels, at how quickly the solution level drops, the ability of the sealant to act to keep the solution in place. There's different types of solutions, and so we were looking at, well, which solution should we be keeping? And that was all part of the significance assessment. So one of the particular outcomes, or one of the things we established, was that yes, we need to eyeball the collection at least every year, every 1 to 2 years, walk and look and eyeball all the collection and see where, if any, the solution has dropped to what we consider a particularly dangerous level, and then we'd need to top up that solution and investigate why it's evaporating perhaps more quickly than any others, and look at resealing the top of the case.
Thanks, Nikki. All that leaves now is to thank our three speakers, and thanks to you all for coming out today. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.